Bing bong. I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast where I've got a very special guest, Stefan Lavera. So if you know anything about Stefan, he's outstanding. He dives into the weeds when it comes to everything that comes into Bitcoin development, coding, all that kind of stuff. We didn't dive super deep in there, so don't expect the most complex thing and you'll get lost and whatever. I had him break down some of these topics and make it very easy for you to understand. We talked about that and a lot of, digital nomading. He moved from Sri Lanka to Australia to Dubai. So we talked a lot about that and kind of, the digital nomad type of life. And as always, please hit that subscribe button wherever you get podcasts. Help spread the word of the State of Bitcoin podcast. And as always, ladies and gentlemen, this is not financial advice. Everything you hear in this podcast should not be taken as financial advice. And big shout out to my sponsor, shout out to the Orange Pill app. If you're looking to connect with local Bitcoiners wherever you're at, I'm traveling around a bunch, but I'm also looking for Bitcoiners when I'm back home. You can find them on the Orange Pill app. Wherever you go, you can utilize the sign up link below in the show notes and you'll get 10,000 sats. I'm giving you free sats to kind of help you out when you sign up. And there is a little bit of a paywall, but it helps you weed out the bots, weed out the fakes. You don't want any of that. So go ahead and sign up for the Orange Pill app. Use the link in the show notes below. And shout out to the Bitcoin Advisor. Go to content.thebitcoinadvisor.com/greencandle. And I can help you get your Bitcoin off an exchange with Collaborative Custody Model. Help you set up with some estate planning. Help you out with some big buys if you need it as well. And lastly, big shout out to Bitcoin Racing. I am the official media partner of Bitcoin Racing. So please, please, please give it give them a follow, check them out. And if you want to donate, go to bitcoinracing.com/partners and you can help them out there, make a donation. And shout out to my boys, Primetime Chris. He's about to make some waves. So be sure to be on the lookout for that. All right, enough for me. Let's get into the episode. And I almost forgot about the Geyser Fund that I'm working on. So I have a Geyser Fund. I am also going to put that in the show notes. So if you guys want to donate, feel free to help the mission. I am giving away some shout outs on there. So the first shout out is Fabio, my boy from Bitcoin Bay. He wanted me to tell him that I'd kiss him on the mouth. So I don't know. I mean, maybe you got to get Fabio all checked out to see how he's doing. I don't know. Maybe he's crushing on me these days. But Fabio, thanks so much for the donation, brother. I appreciate you and everything you're doing for Bitcoin Bay. And now let's get into the episode. And I guess I'd kiss Fabio on the mouth for $25 worth of sats. So I guess that's what Green Candle's coming to. So donate to help your boy out and help me keep improving what I'm doing. Bing bong. I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Stefan Lavera sitting here with me. And we're going to talk about a bunch of different topics from going from Australia to Dubai. Is Dubai a Bitcoin or a crypto haven? But first, I want to start off with ordinals. You've talked with Pete Rizzo, who's obviously very bullish on the ordinal side of things, but you've also had an interesting conversation with Giacomo Zucco. You have a lot of great interviews with people on the other side of things as well. So I want to start it right off the bat. What is your viewpoint when it comes to ordinals, and are they an attack on Bitcoin or not?
Right. And so I'll just quickly explain what they are for people. So ordinals is this, it's an arbitrary made-up protocol that relates to, let's call it, serializing Satoshis, right? Satoshis, you know, on the protocol level are fungible. And it's this idea of, let's say, numbering, quote-unquote, numbering them in a way and spelling out how they, quote-unquote, transfer across Bitcoin transactions such that if you opt into this arbitrary view, you can hold some ordinals. The other elements of this are leveraging the ordinals protocol. There are other ideas like inscriptions and to a lesser extent, BRC20 and others that relate to actually attaching arbitrary files to Bitcoin's blockchain. Now there are some people who believe that, yes, you should try it. It's spam and that you should try to filter it. And some would also go even further and say it's a scam. Like it's literally scamming people just like NFTs are scams in their view. Now, for me, I think they are spam. I would not invest in them. I would not promote them. I view it more like email spam. But I also want to understand and recognize the nuance that it's not that easy to stop this stuff, because it is like spam, and spam on the internet is hard to stop. So I'm somewhere in the middle, in the sense that I don't believe that filtering at the node level will actually stop these things. So what do I mean there? So people are saying, okay, what if we updated Bitcoin Core? What if we got enough people to run some of these implementations or software that tries to filter out these ordinal or inscriptions or BRC20, etc. So Bitcoin Knots, which is by Luke Dasher, or Disrespector, which is another patch I believe you can run. The idea is that if enough people ran that, and if enough people, let's say, point their hash rate using, you know, Stratum V2, or point their hash rate towards Ocean and other pools that allow you to sort of help filter that out, that, you know, you might make it harder for the spammers. Now, I think in practice, it's just going to be difficult, because it's a two-way market in some ways, because the spammers want to spam, and then there are miners out there who want to, let's say, mine the spam, in my view. Now, I don't believe we have enough, let's say, ability to socially push those miners. Maybe there's some level of social ability to push those miners, but realistically, many of them are more mercenary. And maybe if you could bring it, if you could sort of keep promoting this argument that, hey, look, spam is bad for Bitcoin, it would be better not to mine this spam into Bitcoin blocks. Maybe you can make a little bit of progress there. But at the end of the day, spammers could just simply run old versions of Bitcoin Core. They could run specially patched versions. Or, you know, even if you got this into Bitcoin Core, they could run specially patched versions. To me, it seems very difficult to actually meaningfully stop the spam. Like, at best, you could sort of delay it, but realistically, that spam will just get relayed by some other Bitcoin node and get mined in by some other Bitcoin mining pool. So that's where I'm at. Like, I don't like it. I think it's not good for Bitcoin, but I would also say I don't think it's like a huge systemic issue for Bitcoin, because there are responses to that also, right? Like, so we should sort of talk about some of those also, because, for example, the main concern that a lot of the anti-spam people have is that it is making it harder to run a Bitcoin node. And so maybe in the future, that just means more people will use some of these other technologies that help you run a node faster, things like Assume UTXO, U3XO, and maybe some other optimizations, things like Zero Sync. Those are some examples that people might use as an alternative, or at least a way to speed up and make it easier for people to run Bitcoin Core or Bitcoin nodes. And so, I mean, there's some of the debates back and forth in that as well, that, okay, how much is it adding to the chain, or things like that. I think it's more of a, to me, it's a little more philosophical than it is a technical point, right? To me, it's philosophically, the point of Bitcoin is a monetary network. So the network should not treat adding or attaching arbitrary files to the chain as a supported use case. And I would say that historically, developers took a stronger line against that, right? Like, if you search, you'll find things like mailing list posts from people like Greg Maxwell and others who are saying, you know, how do we stopping, oh, I can't remember the exact wording, but it's something like stopping arbitrary file storage or data storage. And so clearly, this was something developers used to do, and they used to focus on that. Right. So the counter argument from the pro spam people would be something like, look, there's, you know, maybe in those days it was a different time, different place. It was a lot smaller. People weren't, you know, maybe there wasn't as much of a market for the spam now, whereas now it seems that there's a, you know, a lot of people who want to gamble, let's say, on BRC20 or other, you know, elements of this quote unquote ordinals, to use the umbrella term. And so therefore you're not going to be able to stop them, because they have this incentive to spam. So, you know, another counter argument there might be like, look, just, you know, don't worry so much about it, and just wait it out, right? Like, maybe just accept, just bite the bullet. And I think that's something I can sort of see that point also, that I can see something as slightly bad for Bitcoin, but realistically, it's one of those situations where many of the things that we try to do in response to it might actually make things worse. So it's sort of like, at what point do you just quote unquote bite the bullet and just say, look, I'm just going to bite the bullet? But I would say the main thing for me, in terms of having explained all of that, I think the main thing where I land is just to say, look, treat them like email spammers. Don't support them. Don't promote them. Don't buy into their frame, right? Like this idea that you should buy into their frame that, oh, that's legitimately building on Bitcoin. It would be, to me, the analogy is like email spam. Like imagine we were early in the days of email and we're trying to promote this thing and get more people to adopt email. We wouldn't invite the Nigerian prince scammers to speak on the stage at the email conference, in my view, right? Whereas, you know, the view of the spammers will be something like, oh, look, see, it's just like email marketing. And look, there's email marketing conferences. And, you know, it's quote unquote legitimate commercial use in their view. Whereas I don't see it like that. I see Bitcoin more like when you're running your Bitcoin node, yes, you run it in a selfish way for yourself, but there's also a sense in which it's a commons. It's like a common resource. And I think the spammers are, let's say, abusing that. They are exploiting that common resource to profit for themselves. And they want to push up all this rhetoric about, oh, see, if you don't like my spam, you must be trying to censor Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is about censorship resistance. And therefore, you're bad, or this is, you know, whatever. That's kind of part of the rhetoric that they will use. They'll try it because obviously spammers will not admit that they are spamming. So I think the simple way to look at it is to say, look, if you view Bitcoin as a monetary network, we could argue that people who run Bitcoin nodes, you are implicitly agreeing to this idea of storing and relaying and forwarding monetary transactions. That's kind of the implicit agreement, but they didn't necessarily agree to storing and forwarding everybody else's arbitrary data on chain, like the JPEGs and the JSON files and all this other stuff that the ordinals people are doing. So yeah, short answer, I think it's spam. I don't believe we can successfully stop them. And just be honest.
Yeah, and I think that's a pretty unique view, right? I mean, it is spam, but you know, like you said, with Bitcoin, it's supposed to be this open source network and whatnot. So, I mean, if we try to stop them now, there's going to be more scammers that come on down the line. But I got a deeper question for you, just on kind of on like the layer one sort of aspect of things, because I think, you know, with ordinals, right, it's been kind of the narrative that, you know, it's a big part of the reason why the layer one transactions, the fees have gone astronomically high. Now, originally, was the, like, I guess the first like Bitcoin core, like layer one kind of technology, was that meant to be able to be hold transactions for 8 billion people? Or was this kind of always a part of the plan where there would need to be layer twos or layer threes or something like that in order to make it a monetary network that, you know, that I guess the entire globe could run off of?
So even that is a debated question in the early days, right? I think people, this is where some of the debates come up. People point back to Satoshi's writings or the white paper or things like this, where Satoshi said something like, oh, we can just raise the block size, right? And that was obviously hearkening back to 2016, 2017. That was a big debate, right? Like literally that was called the quote unquote block size wars. So there was a big debate about that. I think the direction the community decided was, no, we're going to do the layered approach. We're not just going to scale on chain. We're not just going to raise the block size. We're going to do it by layers. And that's where this whole approach with Lightning and so on is coming. And so, yes, it's correct to say that, look, people should not expect that doing on-chain transactions should just be really cheap forever. Like, that's just not a realistic expectation. There are realistic limitations to Bitcoin as a system, and we should embrace, we should understand those, right? It's not to say, oh, Bitcoin is going to fail, it's all over. It's more just to say, look, there's certain trade-offs and certain decisions that Bitcoin makes in order to stay decentralized, right? It's again, biting the bullet in a certain way to say, yeah, we're currently under a paradigm of 4 million weight units per block. And, you know, realistically, it means, let's say, somewhere between 2,500 to maybe 4,000, maybe 5,000 transactions per block. Like, call it, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 transactions in a block is kind of what we're generally getting right nowadays in terms of, you know, blocks and how many transactions are there. And, you know, I see it like maybe we could argue that, like, some of these ordinals, spam and so on, is prematurely pumping those fees higher than they otherwise would be. So maybe that part you could say, but realistically, it's also, we should also be honest and say, yeah, fees were going to rise, right? Fees were always going to rise. We've got to be comfortable with that, especially during bull runs. You just see, that's just what happens. You see a lot more fee pressure happen. And so we should just be okay with that. I understand that also is more difficult for those people who, let's say, focused on, let's say, Global South adoption, because obviously, as Bitcoiners, we want to encourage people, not your keys, not your coins, hold your own keys. But that's going to be difficult over time because there will be people who are priced out. And that's a hard reality to accept. I mean, as we speak today, I'm checking mempool.space now. It's the 8th of March. It's 19 sats per Vbyte, or about, in fiat terms, $1.81 to get next block confirmation. But of course, it can really vary. Like if there's a lot of spam happening, or if there's just genuinely a lot of people who want to transact, that can rise. And then that can start to become more limiting in terms of how many people can transact on chain.
And then, yeah, I guess from there, right, the layer two, the Lightning Network, right? I mean, I feel like the narrative is right. Lightning is kind of the way right now to the average person. But, you know, whenever I talk to devs or somebody that's kind of in the weeds of things, they always say, like, we're not even close to ready for, you know, I guess full mass adoption when it comes to the Lightning Network, even when it comes to something as, you know, like Strike does, right, where it's more of remittance payments opposed to just like straight up, I guess, like peer-to-peer transactions. But, you know, I guess what do you think is needed for Lightning Network? And I guess another deeper question from that is, do you think that the Lightning Network as it stands today would be able to sustain mass adoption? Or do you think that we need to take it maybe even potentially a step further?
So in terms of how many people can use Lightning today, I think that number, if you were to kind of ballpark, I think it's somewhere between 10 million to maybe 100 million. But to be honest, it's probably more like, it's a bit lower, maybe 10 to 50 million. Some would argue more like 10 to 20 million can use it today, non-custodially. That's just sort of some of the realities of using the chain. And so I think, but that said though, I think talking about like, oh, 8 billion people, etc., maybe that's just too early. Like maybe we just need to focus more on low-hanging fruit and more on like what we can do now in terms of getting more exchanges to support using Lightning, right? We're probably nowhere near that, even that 10 million or 20 million threshold of people who are regularly using Lightning, right? So why don't we just get that first? And I think, I would like to see more advancement, but I want it to be very safe and conservative, right? So for me, I'm not saying like, hey, let's just get out there and turn on anything and whatever. No, I think perhaps a safe and conservative, low risk covenant soft fork, something like CTV or L-Enhance or APO, something like that. I see that as potentially a path forward, but I don't want to do it out of consensus, right? Like I want to sort of do this in a way where people are comfortable and they're sort of brought on board. They're sort of saying, yes, if they see the benefit of using some of these covenants, because maybe it allows us to get more efficiency and allow more people to use the chain and to sort of use the chain more efficiently. And so maybe that takes the number from, instead of 50 million, maybe now it's 200 million, or maybe now it's 300 million or 500 million who can use Bitcoin. So that's sort of, I think that's the slow, steady, safe and conservative approach. I would note that CTV has been around, if I recall, since 2019, around there. So we're talking like 5 years or so that CTV has been around. So it's not like a new idea just being rammed down everyone's throats. Like it's been around for a while, but I also appreciate there are other people out there who are cautious about it. Maybe they haven't really thought about it. Maybe they haven't learned a lot about it. Or maybe they just sort of have an initial reaction of like, whoa, like what is this thing? So I'm just trying to be sensitive to that. But yeah, I think steady and slow and conservative moves forward, like incremental steps forward. Like let's say we got CTV, and then that would allow a new round of developers going ahead. Or let's say we did L-Enhance, right, which includes the ability for the Lightning developers to do something like, you know, to advance to using LN symmetry. Like maybe then there's more improvements that could be done, and it could make Lightning safer and better that way. And so we could sort of take these incremental steps but just being very safe and conservative so that we make sure that there's not like some kind of negative externality or there's not some negative impact to other users. So I think that's how I'm seeing it. It's not certain, right? We don't know what the future holds. We don't know what people will be comfortable with, and we don't know what the Bitcoin wizards are going to find. Like, there's a bunch of people researching different directions and trying to think about the path forward. So there's so many moving pieces here.
Yeah, I know there is a bunch of moving pieces, but I'm going to put you on the spot here again, because there was a great panel that I was that I sat back and listened to while I was at Bitcoin Atlantis, where obviously we ran into each other there as well. But it was about Lightning with custodial versus non-custodial. Now, that seems kind of be a hot button topic, because obviously it's easier to scale with a little bit more on the custodial side of things, but also that brings, you know, some counterparty risk. So from your side of things, do you think it's possible to scale and get to the point where, you know, millions of more people can use Bitcoin or Lightning Network, in a non-custodial way? Or do you think like eventually we're just going to have to get to some sort of custodial aspect where, you know, it's more of, I guess, your savings account is holding Bitcoin and your private keys, but whatever you spend, you're going to need some sort of custodial, I guess, partner or custodial app, I don't know, company, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. So I guess coming back to what I was saying before, it comes down to how much of a constraint are we facing at layer one, right? So coming back to what I was saying, is it 10 to 100 million? That's kind of the ceiling in terms of how many people can realistically access the chain. And so beyond that, yeah, they're going to have to be custodial. And so it'll be some form of custodial something. Now, whether that is some kind of just, you know, wallet of Satoshi or Blink or some just straight up custodial app, or whether it's Cashew or Fedimint, or even people using side chains and things like Liquid, like basically you're trusting the Federation there, we don't really know. But we were saying, right, that on-chain limit, if you want to access and use Lightning, you still need to be able to open and close and periodically manage your channels. And that takes some L1, layer one base chain operations. And so there are just limits that we're going to run into without further technology or without a block size increase, which I think is possible, but, you know, unlikely anytime soon. So I think we are going to be up against those main constraints. So look, the system as it is now, it's going to have a lot of custodial users. So I think we better make our peace with that, right? I mean, unless you're willing to get more aggressive about protocol changes or block size increase, yeah, like you're just going to have to be comfortable with that. Now, that sort of does bring up the question of things like, firstly, some people will argue, what is a layer two? What counts, right? Like, is Coinbase a layer two? Is ETFs, are ETFs a layer two? Or should we be more precise about that? Now, I think the more precise definition is unilateral exit. What do I mean by that? It means, is there a way for you to take your coins back on chain without asking permission from anybody? And right now, it's mainly Lightning that fits in that category. You could argue, perhaps, that state chains, the Mercury layer stuff, is potentially also in this category, but there's not a lot of adoption of that yet. In the future, hypothetically, like if we got Arc as an example, that could also count as another layer two with a unilateral exit. Otherwise, you're sort of stuck with varying shades or gradations, let's say. So somewhere in the middle, maybe like a Fedimint or federated things like Liquid is there. Now, some people say that's controversial, right? Like that you shouldn't talk about other, like that's something else. That's not Bitcoin, right? Because for some people, they see that as like, you know, that's beyond the pale for them. Whereas I think just being realistic about the way things are going to go is, yeah, there will be a lot of custodial users of Bitcoin, and it's going to reach a point where, let's say, coming back to that, what we were saying, call it 10 to 50 million. Call it the 50 million richest people or entities in Bitcoin. They will be able to transact on chain, but other people will be having to use a custodial app. Now, there's different ways to frame this point. You could say, look, it's still in the context of 21 million cap. It's still in the context of it's cheap to run a Bitcoin node and verify the limit and make sure, you know, not more than 21 million. It's still in the context where today the number of fiat banks that exist in the world is something like 40,000 Bitcoin, like just fiat banks. In that, in the world we're talking about, we're talking 10 million to 50 million Lightning banks existing. So that's already a huge improvement. You could argue that maybe they, you know, if one bank is going bad or whatever, you can leave one bank and go to another. And what we're talking about is a world with 10 to 50 million Lightning banks. That's way better than today with 40,000 fiat banks. So you could argue that, okay, maybe that's at least better. And hopefully with further technology improvement, that number could rise. It might be hundreds of millions of banks that are possible with further technology improvements. So I think that's, you know, I think that's the honest pathway forward. I think the conversations around like, oh, it would take too long for 8 billion people to open their channels. Like, I just think that's not realistic, at least not anytime soon. You know, it's just not a realistic kind of path to go down. I think it's more just steady, safe, incremental improvements.
Yeah, and that's all fair to say. But, you know, the one issue that I'm kind of seeing here, I mean, I'm in the US where, you know, they're making it very difficult to have these custodial Lightning wallets. So in my eyes, I think, you know, if they're going to do an attack on Bitcoin, maybe I'm going to give like the SEC and some of these regulators way too much credit here. But I think the way that they're kind of attacking it in the US is smart if you're looking at it from their perspective, because they're attacking the custodial and Lightning wallets, right? So in order for us to transact, they're making it very difficult, right? I mean, I think, you know, out of the US, like Lightning wallets, right? You can't really have like Wallet of Satoshi or like Moon is even really difficult to use. Like Blink isn't here in the US. Like a lot of these ones where it's non-KYC, you just are, they're just making it difficult or not making it accessible to the average person. So you got to use things like Strike and Cash App and what have you. And so if you wanted to have non-KYC Bitcoin, it's like you essentially have to have it on chain or like, you know, get it from a peer-to-peer, like kind of, you know, experience some of those higher fees. So the higher, I guess, net worth individuals will maybe take that risk, but the average Joe Schmo probably wouldn't be able to afford that. They would need to, you know, go for the smaller DCAs on a place where they would have to KYC. So then the government would have to, I guess, overlook that. Do you think that that's, I guess, like, you know, the custodial risk of Lightning would make it kind of, I guess, easier for a government to attack or, you know, I guess, in a sense, make it difficult to have that non-KYC Bitcoin? And then, you know, it's okay, like we're using Bitcoin in a sense, but, you know, the government's still able to, I guess, kind of track your payments back and forth, unless you're just like really tech savvy and really able to get around it, which, you know, the average person, I don't really have too much faith in being able to do that.
So I think it's just going to take time for further development. I think, like you said, the American government is particularly aggressive about AML and sanctions laws. And so for that reason, there are various companies who previously offered these custodial Lightning wallets starting to shut it off for US users. So it may be that US users who want Lightning have to use a KYC service, right, to be their custodial Lightning provider. It may be also, but here's the other thing. There might be some of these FediMint or other style Lightning accessing Lightning apps that are outside the US. And so that might be another pathway for some people in the US who really want to be able to use day-to-day Lightning level transactions. They might be able to sign up for some of these Federation things or use Liquid or some other thing that has swaps and use those as their, let's say, in-between or go-between for their day-to-day spending, let's say, if they wanted to. So we'll see what happens there. I also think we might see the LSP spec as an example. So I'll give an example here. The LSP spec, I did an episode with Severin Alex Bueller on this, and he's working on the LSP spec. What that is so Lightning Service Provider is LSP, and this spec is so that Lightning wallets can connect to different LSPs. And so the idea in the future would be you could have one particular Lightning app on your phone, but it could connect to LSPs that are outside the US or that are willing to serve US customers. So that might be another example. We'll see exactly where and how that develops, but for now, that's one pathway that, you know, that people, that things could go down. But otherwise, I think the main important thing is that people save with Bitcoin. Directly and natively spending with Bitcoin, I mean, it's great if you can do it, but the most important thing over the next, call it 10 to 20 years, is people being able to save with Bitcoin, because the fiat Ponzi is slowly breaking down over time and people need a way out. And so that's the most important thing.
Yeah, and that's all fair to say, but you talked about a way out. So that's, I guess, a perfect transition to where I'm going to take this conversation next, right? So you were originally from Australia, I believe, like you escaped from Australia to Dubai. So, you know, obviously with Australia kind of during the COVID pandemic, they were very coming down hard on people and things like that. So talk about the transition from, I guess, like the finding the way out from Australia to Dubai. Like, how has that transition been? And yeah, why the big move initially as well?
So for me, it was, well, as you know, certain countries that we think of as being Western world free countries like Australia, Canada, New Zealand, they were some of the worst during COVID, or the COVID tyranny, I should say, because it's becoming clearer and clearer that, you know, the world did not need to lock down. Like, you know, I was against lockdown early, but I think it's becoming, that fact is becoming more clear now to more people. But nevertheless, 2020 was a year that I just was outraged about what was going on around the world. And I was also particularly annoyed that the taxes were so high that, It became clear to me that the Western world was just going the wrong way. And so I wanted to get out. I wanted to find a place, a way to lower my taxes and also have a little bit better travel freedom as well. And so in 2021, that's when I left Australia, and I just basically don't go back. So I've done my best to kind of cut ties with Australia and leave. And so my wife and I, now I married my wife in 2021, and, you know, I married her in Sri Lanka, right? I'm originally Sri Lankan born, right? And so, yeah, then basically Dubai became a really good choice for us, just because it was low tax, it was relatively open, it's safe, it has other benefits. So, you know, and I want to be clear here. I'm not saying there's, you know, one perfect place. Really, you have to choose what trade-off makes sense for you, whether that's, you know, in the Americas, whether it's in Europe somewhere, Asia, Africa, Middle East. Like, you just have to find something that fits your particular needs. And I think for me and for my family, Dubai in the UAE makes a lot of sense, right? It's low tax, it's safe, it's convenient, there's good services. It's great for flight connectivity, right? With Dubai, there's direct flights to so many major cities and countries around the world. So from that perspective, it works. It works for us. Of course, there's downsides to that too, right? Like, it's really hot here in Dubai. You know, I put it this way. I would not criticize the regime in Dubai, right? Like, I just think, you know, just, you know, if you're happy, go there. If not, leave. Like, that's sort of how I'm viewing it. I think it's interesting to me as well that it's not a democracy. In some ways, that, you know, now, I believe the best possible system would be a fully privatized, everything free market system. But I could make an argument as to why monarchy is better than democracy, that there are reasons that people from around the world come to Dubai, they work, and they don't think as much about politics like they do back when they're in their home country. Whereas in much of the West, people get they just become enthralled by the political and cultural wars of, oh, are you pro this or pro that? And we need to rally up the people to sort of tell the government not to ban this or to ban that. Or it just sort of ends up with people spending and hyper-focusing on politics when they could go to other jurisdictions that are more amenable to people just working and earning money and looking after their families and whatever other hobbies they have. Whereas, yeah, it's just a different way that people operate, which is funny. And here's the thing, the same person, right? Like, people talk about, you know, I've spoken to people here saying they know, let's say, Lebanese people who come here from Lebanon to Dubai or to UAE, and they work, and, you know, there's not really that much politics. They just kind of, they make their money and they look after their family, whatever. But then they go back home to Lebanon, and now they're back in the political debate, and they're constantly arguing about this and that and constantly fretting about what the state is going to do to them. And so it sort of shows you that you can take a it matters where you are, where you are. Like, you, the same person, can be kind of acting in a different way depending on which country you're in and what the conditions are there and what kind of living environment and working environment you're in.
Yeah, that's all fair to say. And I mean, that's a great point, because, you know, I mean, I've heard a lot of great things about Dubai. I still haven't been, so maybe I got to make a trip out there at some point in time. I probably will here in the near future, I'd assume, with a bunch of growing Bitcoin events and things like that. But, you know, something that's been very interesting to me about Dubai is that, you know, you kind of, you know, obviously you got into a little bit of the political aspect of things, but the tax haven aspect has attracted a lot of people, whether it's in the Bitcoin space, but more particularly, I guess, like the crypto space. So, like, from that aspect of the things, would you consider, I guess, Dubai maybe just, is it simply just a tax haven? Or do you think, like, you know, maybe it's a Bitcoin haven, or even, like, to a greater extent, like a crypto haven, where all these, like, I guess, crypto bros are kind of moving out there to kind of, I don't know if it's necessarily hide, but to kind of, you know, I guess, go out there and one, avoid the taxes of wherever they originally came from, or as well, like, you know, kind of maybe avoid the hammer coming down on them if, you know, it turns out their project is kind of scammy, if that makes sense.
So, yeah, there's definitely a lot of the crypto bros who were and are coming out to Dubai. And so, yeah, there is that element of it. But I would say there is also a more genuine, smaller Bitcoin group here in Dubai. And so we have our Bitcoin meetup that's been running for years, and we get a decent turnout at our meetups. Recently this year, we had Bitcoin Oasis. And so that was a really Bitcoin-focused conference here. And so I was one of the MCs for that. So, you know, there is a growing Bitcoin scene. And, you know, the fact that there's this kind of crypto and, you know, shitcoin world also, you know, I just don't interact with them. You know, like, it's simple. Like, you just don't have to interact with them if you don't want to. And so I don't. I mean, I go to the Bitcoin meetup, and I go to our, you know, whether that's lunch and dinner and whatever with Bitcoin friends. And, you know, we've got a pretty good growing scene over time. And the other interesting thing with Dubai is some people use it as they might have a base here or residency rights, and maybe it's a second home here. They only spend some of the year here. So there's that element to it also, because they might have a home here, spend some of the year here, and some of the year somewhere else. And so, you know, so be it. There's people who do that. And then there are other people who just live the full year round in Dubai. So yes, so basically the short answer, coming back to your question, is yeah, there's a bunch of shitcoin people here, but oh well. I think the overall environment is just beneficial for people who want to save money and ideally, you know, not have to pay such high taxes, right? So yes, it's 9% corporate tax at the corporate level, but it is 0 personal income tax. And that's also really cool because it's no capital gains tax. And so from a personal hodling perspective, it's actually really cool because coins that you earn here in Dubai and then you spend in your personal name, there's no capital gains tax. So that's really cool. And it means there's no, you know, record keeping and accounting requirements with like capital gains and things like that. So it's actually really convenient from that perspective. So yeah, there's a few different elements to that. I also get a sense, I'll put it this way. I get a sense that certain countries are trying to be competitive. They're trying to be, you know, treat people like customers instead of subjects. And you'll notice that there's certain Western countries around the world where they treat you like you're a subject. They treat you like you are just their tax cattle to be milked and farmed. Whereas I think the world is offering choices and options. And there are lots of jurisdictions out there, right? People think of it like, oh, it's only Australia, USA, UK, Canada, and that's all there is. No, there's actually a lot of countries around the world. And here's another interesting point I'll make. A lot of people have it in their mind that the number of countries in the world is a fixed thing. No, it's actually rising. The number of territories and states is rising. We're seeing countries split up. So as an example, things like Serbia and Montenegro, right? And they split off. Czechoslovakia is now Czechia and Slovakia, right? And if you look over, let's say, a 100-year time scale, there's a bunch of countries that have split off. secession movements or various splitting off movements. Obviously, there was, you know, post the Cold War, the USSR breakdown, and a lot of countries came out of that. And so what you'll find is that some smaller states sometimes, now, it's not a guarantee, but smaller states can sometimes offer more liberty. Why? Because they have to be competitive. And so that's also an interesting competitive dynamic, that if you're looking out there and saying, well, okay, maybe I don't have to treat it like I'm just stuck in this place that I was born in or that I was brought to as a child, and therefore I have to just stay there and pay high taxes for the rest of my life. Well, no, you could go elsewhere and you could save that money. You could stack those sats, right? And you could compound it in your favor or in your family's favor. And so there's different ways to look at it, right? Like, you could look at it like, oh, I'm just stuck in this one country. Or you could look at it like, no, actually, there are options out there. I can find something that suits what I'm looking for, whether it's low taxes or something else. And you can save money that way, and you can find what you want. There are sometimes hard choices and trade-offs you have to make, but so be it.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point, kind of looking at it more of like a customer opposed to like a subject, because, you know, I mean, obviously El Salvador comes to mind with everything that Bukele's got going on there. He's like made it sort of a tax haven as well for Bitcoiners to come down there and build, maybe not quite to the extent of, Dubai. But, you know, do you think, I guess this is going to be a growing trend where it's like, you know, more of these countries are going to start to make it advantageous. Like, some of the smaller guys are going to make it so, you know, that because of the rise in digital nomad and, like, you know, the remote work, that kind of aspect of things, it's like, hey, come live wherever XYZ country is. It's, it might not be exactly where your family is or whatever, but, you know, you get to save some money, you get to stack those sats, and you get to live in a different country and experience something new. So I guess, like, long-winded question, but do you think that that's going to be kind of a growing trend as the digital age is kind of rising as well?
Yeah. So, yeah, I obviously agree with that. I think I'm bullish on countries like El Salvador and the UAE for obvious reasons, right? Like, I live in the UAE, so I kind of have to be, I have to be bullish on it in that sense. But I think there will be certain countries that recognize the opportunity and understand that if they make certain changes to be competitive, they can attract people. They can attract investors, entrepreneurs, high-skilled workers, and they can attract the right people to their shores. And so I think El Salvador, Dubai, the UAE, other countries out there are doing that. They're trying to do that. It's not perfect, right? There's no one true perfect place that you go to. You just have to sort of accept certain trade-offs. There are other parts in Asia that I might be interested that might be interesting in the future. There are, you know, maybe for people who are, let's say, more willing to get out there on the frontier, maybe parts of Africa would be interesting too, because now it's you know, a less developed economy. Maybe there's an opportunity for you if you're an entrepreneur or an investor, that maybe you see opportunities there. So for me, obviously, I'm you know, I like Dubai, but I'd be, you know, open to looking at what other places are, you know, good in the future. So we don't know for sure, but I think I'll make this other point while we're here. I think a lot of the Western world is sadly in a trap that's hard to get out of. Why do I say that? It's because there's certain entrenched interests that sort of keep a society on a certain track. So whether that is the housing market going crazy, like, if I look back to what's going on in Australia, I can see there's a rental crisis and people are arguing about, hey, how much immigration has the Australian government done in terms of, you know, how much immigration they let in. Versus how many new houses were created, and now there's housing, you know, difficulties. There are people, like, you know, families are sleeping in cars or in tents because they can't afford a place because there was so much immigration. Now, to be fair, there's also business owners in Australia who are saying, hey, we need talent, we need immigration, you know. So it's kind of a multifaceted problem that some of these countries, as an example, they didn't really have a great fertility rate, right? They weren't producing a lot of children. And so then they sort of naturally see it like, well, hey, we need to just have a lot of immigration to make up for it and plug that gap. But then it's causing these other issues because maybe the housing market is a problem or these other, you know, there's just these political issues that are happening. And as an example, what you're getting is these demographics, these kind of demographic battles. So as an example, and it's probably similar in parts of Canada and other parts of the world, but older generations who have housing, they naturally want to restrict the development to keep their property values high, right? Because the political system, the financial system is sort of architected for number go up in property value, right? It's not architected for number go down. That would be a real problem for them. And at the same time, look at what's happening for younger generations. Younger generations like the millennials and the zoomers are shut out of the property market. They have to either move really far out or just rent. And they're paying a lot of money to even try to get on the property ladder per se. And so now that makes it harder for them to have children. And so there's just this really kind of negative spiral that's happening in much of the world. And it's, you know, it's unfortunate. Elon talks about the fertility crisis and, you know, there's various people out there saying, yeah, we should be doing what we can to try to, you know, have more children. We should be trying to raise the population. But yeah, it looks like these are going to be serious issues that are faced around the world. And then the other element of it is how are you going to fund, you know, how are you going to fund and support older people as they start aging, out and they're not able to support themselves? What happens when you don't have enough young people who can be the nurses and the support staff that keep the wheels running, keep the wheels turning and keep the lights on? How do you do that? And these are just going to be hard questions and hard problems. And so I think whether countries like it or not, they will be dragged into a competitive environment because they need to attract either, you know, like we were saying, investors, entrepreneurs, workers. They really need a way to attract workers. And if they can't offer good conditions, guess what? People will go somewhere else.
Yeah. And that's, you know, it's a really interesting point. And I think, you know, when Bitcoiners, especially, we kind of sit back and we see, like, I guess the demise of the American empire, so to speak. But earlier in the conversation, you said, you know, we got to wait this thing out to see, you know, in the next 10 to 20 years, if we could get to more of a Bitcoin standard. So I always kind of like to play this thought experiment with people when I have them on the show, is I kind of see like two different paths for us to get to a Bitcoin standard. One, basically the current system just crashes and burns, right? So like everybody that doesn't have Bitcoin is kind of screwed. But at the same time, if you have Bitcoin, you know, you never really know where that's going. Like it's kind of a quick and immediate collapse. Or we have something where it's, you know, 20, 30, 40, maybe even 50 years out, where it's kind of like a slow, gradual grassroots movement, kind of the things that we're seeing now into a development of a Bitcoin standard. So, you know, I guess, how do you think that we get to a full Bitcoin standard? Do you see one of those two ways, or maybe even a different way that I haven't even thought of yet, to get to that point? But yeah, how do you think we get to a full-fledged Bitcoin standard?
So I think this is actually a good point to bring up Corey Clipston's blog post over at swan.com. It's this idea of the race to avoid the war, right? So that's kind of what you're getting at as well. It's like this idea that, look, it's Bitcoin is pretty much going to win. It's a question of when. And you can either have that in our lifetimes, for our children's lifetimes, or it might be sort of when we're gray and old or dead. And, you know, it's sort of like you can do this the easy way or you can do this the hard way. And so many of us alive, right, because Bitcoin will survive. It's just that will Bitcoiners today be the ones who make it there? That's what it comes down to. So that was actually his talk at Pacific Bitcoin last year, or the year before rather. And so I think that's part of what it is we're trying to help get adoption of this thing. And I understand you can't win everyone over. And so it's about trying to reach somebody where they're at, give them the right message of here's why Bitcoin is good for you. Here's why Bitcoin is good for the world. Right. And I like the way Michael Saylor put it, right? There's five levels. You've got the deniers, right? Like a Peter Schiff or someone who's just, you know, full on hates it. Or maybe, and then maybe you've got a skeptic, who's someone who's sort of like, oh, maybe it's good, but maybe the government will shut it down or whatever. Then the next level is like a trader, right? Someone who's like trying to see it like a trading vehicle to kind of trade in and out. Then maybe the next level you get them to is an investor. And then the final level is a maximalist, right? Like a true advocate, a true person who really believes in Bitcoin being a good thing for the world. And so the idea is you have to identify where people are on that spectrum and try to help them get to that next stage, to help them understand, hey, Bitcoin is good for the world. It's good for you and it's good for the world. So that's where we're at, in my view. Now, I think the ETFs are going to pull in a lot of people. Of course, we want to do our part to try to help convert those people into learning the real aspects of Bitcoin, like the freedom and those elements of it. It just comes down to, I think, doing what we can to get people in. And hopefully it happens in that, let's say, 10 to 20 year time frame instead of like the 50 year time frame.
Yeah, I agree. And maybe it'll be a little quicker, right? I mean, it's like the Parker Lewis saying, gradually, then suddenly. But you mentioned the ETF. So I want to wrap things up with one last question here. Like, I guess I'll make it a little bit more broad, where it's like, all right, traditional finance, right? I mean, do you think that it was inevitable that they kind of came in and created this spot ETF? I mean, obviously there were some vehicles like this around the country outside of the US, but the US has the biggest stock market with a lot of people, obviously a lot of inflows kind of coming in. And did you think it was inevitable that the traditional finance would kind of come in? And I guess a two-parter here, are you surprised at the amount of like inflows that we're having when it comes to traditional finance just dumping billions of dollars almost on a daily basis, it seems, into this spot ETFs?
So short answer, was I slightly surprised to the upside? Yeah, a little bit in terms of the inflows. To your question of was it inevitable? Yeah, also, I think it was also going to happen, right? If we can't talk about Bitcoin being permissionless and Bitcoin being the money of enemies without recognizing that, yeah, okay, some people we don't like might buy Bitcoin and use Bitcoin. You know, it comes back to even like the ordinal stuff, right? Like I can't stop it. And I recognize that. And so I think it's the same thing. But coming back to that framework again of, you know, denier, skeptic, trader, investor, maximalist. Yeah, there'll be a bunch of people who now, they used to be deniers and skeptics, and now they are traders. They used to be whatever. They used to be traders, and now they are investors. And so it's just going to advance people up that curve. And the faster we can get more people to the maximalist point, that's a good thing for all of us. Like, we should all be out there. Now, I think there's a way to do it, right? Like, you don't sort of jam it down someone's throat. You don't ram it down their throat. You have to find the right way to sort of, you have to find the right balance in communicating to people the benefits of Bitcoin and why they should support it. And for a lot of people, they're not even really thinking at a logical level. They're more just thinking more kind of like at a tribal and social level, like, oh, what does this other person think? What does this other high status person think? I'll just follow them, right? That's kind of the mindset for a lot of people. So do what you can, get to whoever you can, get them to learn about the real values of Bitcoin and what it really means. Of course, there's books, there's podcasts, there's, you know, you name it. But that's what I view this is, right? It's about trying to get out there and help people understand. Now, you won't be successful with every person you try, right? Just like you wouldn't expect a salesman to get 100% conversion rate. Like, that's just out of this world impossible. You're never going to get that. But we can improve our conversion rate. We can improve our ability by finding ways to teach people about Bitcoin, whether that's using stories, whether that's using, you know, humor and comedy. Like, there's different ways to reach them. And we're all playing our part, right? Like, I think, you know, not everybody is working at that level of bringing in total new coiners. Some of us are working at the level of educating already existing Bitcoiners. And, you know, you play the part as best as you can.
Stefan, this has been an outstanding conversation. So I really appreciate you giving me your time here today on this Friday afternoon for you. So why don't you tell everybody where they can find you and what else you got going on?
Yeah, sure. So everyone can find me, StefanLivera.com. I post my stuff out there on Spotify, YouTube, etc., all the platforms. Anyone interested in Bitcoin or Austrian economics, technology, you can find out more and learn more from my show there. And I also work at Swan.com. So Swan.com is a place where people can obviously buy Bitcoin. There's a range of services. A lot of people think of it as just a DCA, but actually there's more to it. Like, if you're buying larger amounts, there's Swan Private. If you're a business, there's Swan Business. There's Swan Institutional. So there's a range of service offerings there. People can find all of that over at swan.com.
There we go. And I'll put all that in the show notes. Stefan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brendan.